Hey folks, Chris from 302010 here with a special presentation from our buddies at Wondery. This month, as we're celebrating all things American, we wanted to introduce you to a new six-part miniseries, Heritage Road. It starts in the post-depression South with a group of daredevils who were moonshining whiskey for extra cash. They needed fast cars to run away from the tax collectors, and soon enough, they were running against each other, but for fun. One of these daredevils was a better businessman than a driver, and he turned stock car racing into what we know as NASCAR, a phenomenon that's more all-American in more ways than we know. His name was Bill France, and in this first episode, you'll hear about the early days, why including women was essential to his success, and how he got people to pay. Oh, and there's also a murder. You'll be able to catch the remaining five by subscribing to the feed for Heritage Road. As always, you'll be able to find a link in the episode notes. So without further ado, here's Heritage Road.
Most NASCAR drivers make enough to drop a dollar or two in the swear jar. This show is for ages 21 and up. Please listen responsibly.
From the Observer, then he says, next thing up, he's going to do that dancing bears. Well, the next race, I had two dancing bears come in.
NASCAR and dancing bears, they go hand in hand. Stay with me here. Humpy comes from a long tradition of larger-than-life promoters who made NASCAR a spectacle like none other. These guys give P.T. Barnum a run for his money. It started with Big Bill France, and it continues today with Marcus Smith, son of the legendary Bruton Smith. Over the years, the sport has attracted all kinds of characters, including Monty Roberts, the man who turned Busch Beer into the national brand it is today with one important decision, sponsoring NASCAR.
Without Monty Roberts, they never in their wildest dreams would have ever gotten into automobile racing. He knew how to reach massive crowds and get them excited.
This week, we'll be talking with Monty's widow, Laura Roberts, about his life and legacy. But first, we'll meet a couple of those legendary track promoters and learn just how big you have to think to make it in the business of NASCAR.
We got more skybox seats than most NBA, NHL arenas have. Seats. I don't mean skyboxes, I mean seats, period. We've got more toilets than Carnegie Hall has seats.
I'm Rich Phillips, and this is Heritage Road, brought to you by Crisp, Cold, Busch.
We're in the Xfinity Series garage area. We're right outside the tech.
Done everything you can do at a racetrack, from selling tickets to flipping burgers to driving
the race car. It's very refreshing to see the Busch brand get behind what we do.
We always are trying to figure out how to be better, how to one-up ourselves.
He said, where's Victory Lane? I forget. And Kyle said, I know, I'll show you the way.
You leave here hungry, it's your own fault.
That's right.
Hell yeah.
Because I don't care what kind of freeway show you got, I don't care. How many dancing bears or anything else you have. The race better be damn good.
Howard A. Wheeler Jr., better known as Humpy, is one of the greatest promoters racing has ever seen. We're talking everything from all-you-can-eat buffets to cars jumping over sharks. And, of course, those dancing bears. Ringleader, master of ceremonies, carnival barker. A promoter's job is to put butts in seats, and Humpy did that better than anyone. He's never been afraid to think big, and he's always had a head for business.
I have been involved in racing literally since I was about 10 years old. The Charlotte Speedway, where the first cup race was run in 1949, was only 6 miles from where I lived, west of Charlotte, a little town called Belmont. And I'd been over there a few times. I got hooked on racing and all the color and excitement. And I started selling Coca-Colas. That's what got me hooked, and I've been hooked ever since.
But selling Coca-Cola at the track was just the beginning of Humpy's business endeavors.
So when I was 13, I found out that there was a gap in the market in Belmont. They didn't have a bicycle shop. So I opened a bicycle shop in my parents' garage. And
once Humpy made a sale, he would organize races for the kids in the neighborhood with their new bikes. And when they inevitably wrecked, there was only one place in town to get them fixed.
And it actually worked out pretty well. I actually made enough money to do stuff. One of the things was build race cars. Even though I was not even old enough to drive on the street, I drove them at dirt tracks. Now, I wasn't much of a driver. I was also boxing at the same time. And I got the sports mixed up. I hit everybody on the racetrack. And sooner or later, I knew that wasn't going to do any good. So I thought, well, maybe my forte is promoting the races. And so that's what I started doing. I started helping promoters of these tracks try to sell more tickets, and they'd give me...
So Humpy sells tickets for a while. He's making a living, learning the business, and then this opportunity comes along. Driver Marvin Panch owned a track in Gastonia, North Carolina, that was on the verge of extinction. He was ready to leave the business, and he needed someone to take it off his hands. So Marvin called Humpy.
And he said, "You want to take it over?" I said, "I don't have any money." He said, "Yeah, but you got two race cars." So I sold those two race cars and took the money and opened the Robinwood Speedway and changed the rules so people could afford to race much cheaper. It was an absolute success. We had more people coming in there than you could. I mean, if you didn't get there by the 6:30 at the start of a 7:15 race, you had no place to sit. And despite not knowing anything, I thought I did, and I acted like I did, but I didn't. My accounting system then was a chest of drawers. In the top drawer, I kept my money. I just wanted to make sure I knew where I was. So the second drawer, I had my bills. I had more money in the first drawer than bills in the second drawer. Then I was doing pretty well.
To fill the stands at Robinwood Speedway, Humpy pulled out all the stops. He wrote articles for the local newspapers. He dropped flyers from airplanes into neighboring towns. Just four races into his career as an owner, he'd taken a speedway on the verge of extinction and turned it into the hot new track. The stands were so packed that even Bill France, founder and commissioner of NASCAR, began to take notice. But Humpy wasn't too sure he wanted to sign on with the France family dynasty.
Yeah, I sure didn't want to have to go pay the money you had to pay to have a NASCAR sanction. That was ridiculous. And so I just formed the Carolina Racing Associates. So I had my own NASCAR. We were doing so well, some of the NASCAR promoters really started griping to Bill France Sr. And he called any tracks that weren't NASCAR outlaw tracks. Like there was something devious going on.
Nothing devious, but Humpy's outlaw attitude kept bringing him success. Breaking tradition got spectators through the gates and opened the doors for new opportunities. Soon after shutting down Robinwood Speedway, he was hired to manage Charlotte Motor Speedway, the same track where he'd sold Cokes as a kid. A few years and one live cheetah later, Humpy gets hired as president of Speedway Motorsports, eventually managing seven tracks across the country. But the new job titles and the growing audiences never changed the way Humpy dreamed up his best ideas.
The most creative kid in the world is 12 years old. He's into nothing but fun. His hormones haven't hit yet. And the only thing he cares about is having fun. So what would appeal to him would appeal to the world. And people used to tell me, I had a 12-year-old mind. And I'm kind of glad I did and still do. I don't think I ever got over 12 because that's the fun part of life. When I was a kid, I'd go to a track and the race would start at 7:30 and you'd get there at 6:30 and nothing happened. It was just a bunch of people sitting in the grandstand. There was no entertainment. There was no nothing. And I thought, gosh, I've got to do something else.
And that something else? Well, to Humpy, it meant launching a school bus through football goalposts. While napalm exploded underneath it. Or the Great American Taxi Race, complete with toll booth. That lasted two laps. Or the time he had U.S. Army paratroopers invade the speedway. And then Humpy brought in the Navy, who brought a destroyer. But Humpy wasn't just about big spectacles. He knew how important it was to pay attention to the little things. He was one of the first promoters to work with traffic engineers to get fans home quickly and safely. Before every race, he made a point of personally thanking each member of his janitorial staff with a crisp $20 bill. That's just the kind of guy he was. He was flashy, but he was humble.
Some of the best ideas I ever got were from common, ordinary people. And one thing about them is they'll open up real fast and tell you what they don't like. And that's okay. That's what you want to hear. You don't care about what they like. You know what they like. look at the ideas other people have and learn the good ones and put them to use.
Humpy made a life's work of putting those good ideas to good use. He's retired now, but while we were out wandering the Midway in Charlotte, we ran into the guy who's got Humpy's old job, current Speedway Motorsports president and CEO, Marcus Smith. He was there doing the same thing Humpy used to do, hanging out with the fans before a race. It's something Marcus has been doing pretty much his whole life. It's kind of unavoidable when your dad is a NASCAR legend. Bruton Smith is responsible for building Charlotte Motor Speedway and founding Speedway Motorsports, the Fortune 500 company that now runs 8 tracks across the country, including my home track, Texas Motor Speedway. Marcus, to say the least, has some pretty big shoes to fill.
It's a passion of mine and our whole company to over-deliver and exceed expectations for all of our fans coming to the races. And I love that fans aren't afraid to give us some good feedback. Thankfully, a lot of it's positive, but every once in a while I get some good constructive criticism. You can never get better if somebody doesn't tell you what you're doing wrong. You're in constant improvement mode. We always are trying to figure out how to be better, how to one-up ourselves. You know, that's just kind of in our blood.
Big Bill France, Humpy Wheeler, Bruton and Marcus Smith, these are the kinds of larger-than-life characters it takes to rise to the top in a business like this one. You have to think big. And I know one guy who thinks bigger than just about everyone. He's my boss, president of Texas Motor Speedway, Eddie Gossage.
I have done everything you can do at a racetrack, from selling tickets to flipping burgers to driving the pace car to flagging races to doing the PA to breaking up fights in the stands and the pits. You name it, you know, and it was a great lesson, a great way to learn.
Eddie was learning everything he needed to know about running a racetrack at Nashville Speedway, the second oldest continually operating track in the U.S., which may explain why he got the chance to take on a leadership role at another track just one season later.
And so after a season, they said, you need to go to Bristol and run Bristol. So here I am, 21 years old, and I've got 2 cup races. And a secretary and a maintenance man, and that was it. So that's how you did it back then. And there wasn't any money in it. I mean, I had to call R.J. Reynolds and see if they were throwing out some office furniture because we didn't have office furniture, things like that. I mean, that's what you do. All of a sudden, I was really thrust into the biggest level of major motorsports in America, which was a great thing to do. But I was gone 40-some-odd weekends a year and still had to be at work on Monday morning. So after about 6 years of that, I was offered a job at Charlotte Motor Speedway. Several years into that tenure, Bruton Smith called and said, let's build a speedway. And I said, why are you calling me? And he said, let me rephrase that. Go build a speedway. And so I said, where? And he said, I don't have a clue. Figure it out. And that speedway was Texas.
In 1995, Texas Motor Speedway was just a big open field, miles away from Dallas and Fort Worth. But by the mid-90s, thanks to the work of visionaries like Big Bill and Humpy, NASCAR had entered a new era of popularity. Fans were hungry for more live racing.
We saw all the pieces we needed here to make it work, and from fans to sponsors to a city like Fort Worth, it was easy. I wouldn't want to do it today, but back then, 21 years ago, you didn't have social media. The internet was not a commonly used thing. And so all you had to worry about were 2 newspapers, 4 TV stations, and a handful of radio stations to get the word out. And people were chomping at the bit. When we had our groundbreaking, people honestly were picking up handfuls of dirt and putting it in their pocket. It was more of a managing kind of thing than, trying to whip the crowd into a frenzy. I mean, they were already in a frenzy. This man stopped me one day and he said, okay, tell me the truth. What are you really building out there? And I was like, what do you mean? What are we really, what does it look like? I was like, it's a super target,
It may seem funny now, but the guy did have a right to be suspicious. There had never been a sports arena as massive as Texas Motor Speedway when it was built. But that's just how we do things here in Texas.
I tell people this is a greatest hit speedway because we stole the best from this speedway and the best from that stadium and the best from that arena to put in here to make it what it is today. And we got more skybox seats than most NBA, NHL arenas have seats. I don't mean skyboxes. I mean seats, period. You know, we've got more toilets than Carnegie Hall has seats.
Eddie built it, and they came. Bruton's Field of Dreams moment played out just like the movie. And having been in the announcer's booth for a cup race and seen that crowd of over 150,000, I can tell you personally, all that hard work is paying off. But those 150,000 people didn't just show up out of nowhere. Eddie's success started with a pile of dirt in the middle of Texas. Humpy's success started with a racetrack that was failing in Charlotte. Racing attracts men of vision, risk takers, which leads us back to Monty Roberts.
They gave Monty Busch Bavarian beer, and they said to him, we're changing the name, we're changing the can, and we want it nationwide in all the markets, and it's only in a fourth of the markets now. Four have failed before you, good luck.
But Monty didn't need their luck. By the time Busch came knocking, Monty had made a career out of using big ideas to reignite struggling companies. And a lot of his big ideas involved race cars. Not surprising, considering his first job was with Ford, where he worked his way up to the head of the racing division at Mercury.
He had Cale Yarborough driving, Parnelli Jones, A.J. Foyt. And so if they won, which they did a lot, then Mercury's got it was everywhere. I don't know how he did it, but he really promoted the brand.
So Monty had a powerful position at one of the nation's largest companies. But he didn't stop. He left Ford to spend a few years in Ontario, California. He was running a track we talked about in our last episode. You know, the one where the King locked up the Winston Cup in 1979. Monty was part of the executive team when the racetrack hosted Evel Knievel's record-breaking jump over 19 cars. And then he got a call from a guy named Busch, August Busch, the third.
So the job that they gave to young August was to see if you can make the Busch Gardens into a profit center, not thinking he stood a chance in hell of doing it. So he calls Monty and says, you know, I heard that you're available, and if you can fill up a stadium with 180,000 people, maybe you can get people to come to Busch Gardens.
Thrill rides you can see from miles around, wildlife right outside your car window. Before Monty and August the 3rd came around, it was just a few bird baths in the woods around a brewery. Like I said, you gotta have vision. Monty had it, and so did Busch. After the success of Busch Gardens, they hired Monty to manage the entire Busch brand.
Racing fans are very loyal. So first thing he does is that he decides to get back into the racing world. He developed the Busch Clash, and that was a race for the pole winners throughout the year, and it was a lot of money.
After creating the Busch Clash, Monty convinced Busch to sponsor Cale Yarborough's No. 11 Oldsmobile. Then he got the company to sponsor the NASCAR Busch Grand National Series, now known as the NASCAR Xfinity Series. Monty had taken a regional beer and turned it into a household name, something synonymous with racing.
I'm going to be honest with you. I was really excited to see Kevin Harvick get sponsored by Busch. I mean, Busch is badass. Busch is cheap. It's good. It's a universal beer. You can drink it and not get too toasted but still have fun. Busch is good in my book.
The paint scheme's better, too.
It's
today
amazing.
Today we were looking at it, and I was just like, I never thought a car was so beautiful. So lovely.
That's our producer, Aaliyah, talking with Tim and Andy, members of the Sloppy Yellow Crew, a family of race fans we've been hanging out with at tracks all over the country. Tim's right, that blue paint scheme is awesome. But it's not just a matter of slapping some stickers on a car. Back in the day, Cale Yarborough's team would have to paint the entire body, logos and all, by hand. They didn't want a Busch decal sticking up from the paint job. And as we learned in episode 2, when it comes to aerodynamics, every fraction of an inch makes a difference. But Kevin Harvick's team can't possibly spend their time painting the number 4 Busch Ford by hand. So we got Dr. Deandra Leslie Pilecki-Hilborn back on the phone to teach us a little about how teams do it today. And then I took a closer look at that gorgeous baby blue number 4 in the garage at Richmond. Let's go under the hood.
Imagine your inkjet printer on steroids. So you've got an inkjet printer that's about 8 feet wide, and it prints on this humongous piece of plastic, and it can print anything you can imagine. Well, then you take this piece of plastic and you wrap it around the car, And a team that has really good people can wrap a car in like 30 minutes, but it allows you to do anything. You can do gradients, you can do fancy pictures. They actually laser drill these tiny little holes in the plastic. You can't even see them, they're so small. But what that does is that as you're putting the wrap on the car, it gives all the air a place to get out. It's expensive. In many ways, NASCAR is like NASA. They will spend a little more money on something because for NASA, every bit of weight is money. And for NASCAR, every bit of drag is money.
So Kevin Harvick has just come in from another set of laps here in a final practice for Cup Series. And so this week he's got the Busch Light paint scheme on the number 4 Ford, and it is an awesome looking baby blue scheme that he's got with a Busch Light logo on the hood. And the thing that I always like when I look at paint schemes is for them to be unique and different. If he's my driver, I want him in a car that's going to stand out. And I don't know of any other baby blue cars that are out there. So if you're a Harvick fan, you're going to see that number 4 Ford very easily in Sunday's race.
Before we get back to the show, we've got a favor to ask. We're in a competition with other podcasts to see who can get more completed answers to our survey, and we'd appreciate it if you could help us out. It only takes 5 minutes, and you can do it right on your smartphone. It's at wondery.com/survey. That's wonder, the letter Y, .com/survey. Leave your email in the comment box, and we'll send you a gift as a thank you. Thanks. On the track, Kevin Harvick is front and center, entertaining fans and winning cups. But he's more than just a driver. Like Monty Roberts and Humpy Wheeler, Kevin is always on the lookout for the next opportunity. He started a truck team with his wife Delana in 2001, while he was still driving in the NASCAR Busch Grand National Series.
And really, we started at that particular point to win a truck race. You know, I didn't feel like I had 100%. You know, all the opportunities that I wanted to have to win a truck race. So we started our own truck team to go out and win, and we did that. And that evolved into having full-time truck teams with other drivers driving them. That wasn't really something that we intended to do. It was really just something that we had a part-time team that we were having fun with and just kind of a hobby, I guess you could say. But it turned into a business, and that's really how every business that we've had has happened. It's just kind of happened by being in the right place at the right time, by being successful at doing a little piece of something that, you know, somebody presented a new opportunity with, and you jump on it and take a chance.
Eventually, Kevin shifted from driving trucks to driving cars, and three championships later, it was a pretty good decision. Ultimately, he decided to shut down the truck team and start a family. Opportunities kept presenting themselves, but nothing really grabbed him. Then an idea came along that he could not turn down. Over beers in the infield with a UFC fighter.
One day, I don't even remember what year it was, but Donald Cerrone and myself were sitting in the infield having a beer after one of the races at Texas Motor Speedway, and we'd become friends. And he said, "Why don't you just manage my stuff?" And I said, "Well, that's not something that I had really thought about. We just got out of the, you know, having 140 people. I didn't want to have a bunch of people because I felt like that was the hardest thing to manage." For the people, and you know, racing as an owner is, if you're not a really, really wealthy person when you start, which Dylan and I weren't, you know, there's only one person that's going to fill the gaps when you have the financial slumps of crashing cars or a shortage of sponsorship. And so owning the race teams was a lot of work and a lot of responsibility from a financial standpoint and a time standpoint. So we were fortunate to kind of cherry pick the people that we wanted to keep from a KHI standpoint.
KHI, or Kevin Harvick Incorporated, became KHI Management, the only talent management company I know of that began as a truck racing team. But that's the opportunity that presented itself, and Kevin took it. One UFC fighter turned into a portfolio of talent, including motocross bikers, PGA golfers, and TV personalities.
And for us, we wanted to, after we started seeing what was happening, we wanted to build something that was almost like your stock market accounts or your investment accounts that was very diverse. When you have all these different assets of athletes and entertainers and NASCAR drivers and PGA golfers and all the things that we have, if you can't entertain your customer and our company from the assets that we have, you just literally don't want to entertain people. So, you know, that's just kind of the approach that it has evolved into since that conversation that we had with Donald.
When you're surrounded by 30 cars going 180 miles an hour, hesitation can cost you the win. Drivers can't be afraid to make a quick decision. And Kevin knows that better than anyone. It's what makes him a great driver and a great businessman.
You know, don't be afraid of change, because change brings opportunity. And when you have new opportunities, sometimes you have to take a risk. And you know, I've taken a lot of risk in my careers of changing jobs or leaving the family race team to go be a mechanic at Spears and hoping that you get the opportunity to drive. There's been a lot of risk and a lot of opportunities that you can't just sit back and wait. You have to say, all right, well, you know, it might not work out, but it seems like something that I need to do.
NASCAR wouldn't exist without visionaries, risk takers. Bill France was the original, but guys like Bruton and Marcus Smith, Monty Roberts and Humpy Wheeler made NASCAR what it is today by seeing potential where no one else could. Sometimes the next great idea is as crazy as dancing bears, and sometimes it's as simple as a crisp, cold Busch. Next week, we get back to business on the track and sit down with some of racing's living legends. Heard of Don Miller?
Well, the day that I got in the accident and lost my leg and broke almost every bone in my body, that was a pretty big wake-up call.
After next week, you won't be able to forget it. Heritage Road is brought to you by Crisp Cold Busch. If you like the show, please don't keep it to yourself. Leave a review and tell a friend to subscribe wherever they get their podcasts. Thanks. Heritage Road is produced by Aliyah Tavakolian, Joshua Kumler, and Mark Moncrief, with co-producers Jean-Yale Kastner and Carson McCain, production assistance from Isaac Young, and fact-checking by Stephen Gardner. Lori Pracher is our story supervisor, and our show is edited by Keith Reynolds. Our music is provided by Flavor Lab Producers Toolbox, and the song you're hearing right now under our closing credits is Still Driving by Paul Coffin. Our show is mixed by Will Hensley. Special thanks this episode to Humpy Wheeler, Laura Roberts, Marcus Smith at Speedway Motorsports, and Dr. Deandra Leslie Pilecki-Hilborn. Be sure to check out Humpy's book, Growing Up NASCAR. Heritage Road is a Spoke Media production in partnership with Wondery. Executive producers Keith Reynolds, Jeffrey Glazer, and Hernan Lopez.
Drawn.